Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest today is one of my best friends and the person I enjoy disagreeing with most about matters, but we're going to talk about something I think that we're on the same page about, and that's education. John Hood, welcome. John, you're known across the state as a newspaper columnist, but your work behind the scenes with the John Locke Foundation, previously in direct management, now on the board, is something that we followed. You're also the author of a novel, a fantasy novel set in the times of the American Revolution called Mountain Folks. But what you wrote a column recently about the cost of college and university education and raised the question about whether or not it was worth it. What led you to raise this question and try and suggest possible answers?
Well, this is not a question that is new. People have been asking questions about what we might call the return on investment, ROI, of higher education. People have answered the question for decades by simply saying, well, people who get a four-year bachelor's degree, obviously more than that, but at least a four-year bachelor's degree, earn way, way more than people who don't. And that is the beginning of an answer to the question, but it doesn't get you very far. As I have observed many times, it's just I wrote this column recently because there was a new study that was published by an organization called the Foundation for Research and Equal Opportunity. They were able to do the study because there have been some changes in how the federal government collects and reports information and how other sources have collected and report information with regard to things like someone gets an engineering degree at North Carolina State. What is their earning? What is their average income 10 years later? You know, we didn't have that kind of data even 10 years ago or 20 years ago. We have more of it now. Now, we still don't have a true life cycle. If you went and got an accounting degree at East Carolina, we can't be absolutely confident what that person's earning 30 years later. We don't have that amount of historical data. But even in that case, people have come up with, I think, pretty clever ways of estimating. They use data from the Census
What you're Bureau. Making now versus what
yeah.
Which,
I mean, if you started out as an accountant, we can tell you if you graduated from Chapel Hill with a dental degree or something. We have Chapel Hill, lots of other campuses, the federal government, lots of institutions now collect information that is specific, not just to what school you went to, but what discipline you majored in or got a degree in. So we have some of those data for the first several years of a career or 10 years of a career, and you can reasonably extrapolate from that what the life cycle earnings are. So all of this is to say, DG, that you can now, with a little more precision, say something like, if you got an economics degree at Duke University, undergraduate degree in economics at Duke University, and we subtract the tuition and fees that you pay, and in fact, we could even subtract some other kinds of costs that are borne not by you but by other people, and we can also subtract, you know, if you went to Duke for 4 or 5 years, that's time you didn't work full time, so that's a cost. You can subtract that out and then compare that against the earnings, and we can figure out whether you had a positive or negative return. And by the way, the Duke econ degree, I didn't pull out of the air. Shockingly, that's like a couple of $1 million or more positive ROI. Now, that means, of course, you got to be prepared for the fact that some degrees, if you run this kind of formula, and that's what the folks at FREEOP, the Foundation for Research and Equal Opportunity, did. You got to be prepared for the fact that some of these will be negative. That if you go to college, you get a certain kind of degree from a certain institution, it may not be financially worth your while. Now, that's not necessarily – we'll get to this in a second, I think, DJ. It doesn't necessarily mean you shouldn't do it. But don't do it thinking that you're going to boost your income. And this invites the question of, is the purpose of university – to boost someone's income, which I'll come back to. If you assume that it is the purpose, just for the sake of argument for a second, if you assume that people ought to go to university, not just community college, but university, 4-year degrees or more in order to boost their incomes, and you look at this kind of information, you will find that about a quarter of bachelor's degrees in America today have a negative return. You do not earn enough by getting that degree to make up the cost. Now, that means three quarters work the other way, but a quarter is not a small number. And in fact, if you threw in some other costs that are not directly borne by the student and his or her family, and you consider the fact that lots of people don't graduate in 4 years, you got to add five or six, you know, another 1 or 2 years of cost. DG, you can jack that up to about a third of all bachelor's degrees are not financially profitable. You can so that's just a statement. You can quibble with the numbers. Imagine that they're off by some, and it's really 30% instead of 35, or it's, you know, you can quibble with the points here or there, but it is not an insubstantial number of bachelor's degrees. They do not really have a financial payoff. Now, that doesn't necessarily tell you what you ought to do with that information. You could say, well, some of those people shouldn't go to college. Or you could say some of those people should have gone to college but majored in something different. Or you could say we should have figured out a way to make it cheaper for them to go to college. There's all sorts of ways to go. Or, you know, technical directors of community theaters should make more money or something. I mean, you can answer the follow-up question in lots of ways. But I think that the answer to the initial question, does college worth it, is on average, for most people it is, but for some people it isn't. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's an uncomfortable thing for people to hear, but I wasn't surprised by that finding. That struck me as sort of what you would expect.
What do you think the a prospective college student thinks about when making a decision about which college to go to, what kind of course to take? Are they in any way focused on how much I'm going to make, or are they thinking, I just want to be a college graduate?
Yeah. We could speculate. You and I could talk about people we know, my kid, my two boys, and what they were thinking. Or we could just look at surveys of what college freshmen say. And again, whether we like this or not, overwhelmingly the top reason that kids say they go to college is to boost their incomes. Now, that's probably not all they have in mind. They may also genuinely want to just learn knowledge for the sake of learning knowledge. They may like the sports team or the experience of going off to campus. That's where their dad went. It's where their mom went. It's where their aunt went. They may look forward to making new friends. There's all sorts of people can have multiple reasons to do things. You and I do all sorts of things where we have more than one reason. But if you ask people, what is the top reason why you're going to college rather than going directly into the workforce, it is not, I've always dreamed of reading Socrates, reading Plato's dialogues under, you know, a willow tree. That's not what they say.
They're saying, well, but they're also probably not saying I want to – many, some of my contemporaries even wanted – to make a lot of money, that was it.
Yeah,
that was it. But others, I'm thinking about. You're talking about your boys, and I'm thinking about my two granddaughters, mm-hmm. both of whom are first year students. And we talked a lot about college and where to go. And of course, they're well situated financially. They're mm-hmm. they're so they haven't been taught to be economically concerned, but. In the discussion about where to go to school and then what courses to take, what kind of majors to take, they're thinking about something other
Absolutely.
Than making money. And so
– So did I. I'm a counterexample to this.
Well, tell us about that.
I mean, first of all, I have an identical twin brother, and we were senior years in high school. We hadn't really thought about college. We figured we'd go. We hadn't really planned it. This is the hood way of doing things. It's all going to come together. The plan will come together. Well, we talked about it with our mother, who said, well, I don't really care where you go as long as it's not Chapel Hill. So we applied to Chapel Hill, and that's the only place we applied, and we went to Chapel Hill. Now, my twin brother majored in political science, went to law school. He enjoys the law, but obviously that was partly a way to build a successful career. I started out thinking about the arts because my brother and I were performers and said, well, that's not going to make me any money. So then I majored in journalism, which I'm not sure was a brilliant financial move.
Well, it worked out for you.
I went for many years making very little money. My point is, though, that most students, and I will dare to say an even higher percentage of their parents, see – going off to a four-year school is financially and as primarily an economic or financial decision with some other benefits. And if that is the case, then it is important for them to have as much information as possible so they can make a reasonable decision. And I say all that, and I said this in the column, DG, you may have seen. Now, engineers fared very well in an ROI study. And it's not just
ROI is return on investment.
And so engineering, other kinds of science and math disciplines do very, very well. I was struck, for example, by a degree at UNC Charlotte in fire management, essentially very technical field of building out systems to depress fires in office buildings and designing things to be safe. And very important field, kind of narrow but very lucrative. That was like a $2 million payoff on that degree. Now, the thing is, though, you and I both know people who are engineers or lawyers, sometimes even physicians, who make a tremendous amount of money and are kind of bored or certainly not fulfilled.
Well, this is a good time to take a break. If you join us late, I'm visiting with John Hooden in the context of a recent newspaper column that he wrote about what he calls the return on investment might be in terms of the selection of the courses to take in college, or whether or not you even need to go to college to get a good return on investment. John Hooden, I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with John Hood, who's written recently one of his provocative newspaper columns, this one on the cost of university or college education and whether or not you can get your money back or even get a lot more than your money back. And John, you've introduced this, and talk again just a little bit about why you did this, why you shared this information with
us. If most students and even a higher percentage of their parents and lots of people in the public policy space and taxpayers and people who are involved in funding the universities, if they think the primary purpose of sending young people or not so young people off to college is to boost their incomes, which is not an unreasonable thing to be thinking about, of course, then we need to know exactly what the data look like. Sending someone off to school to get an electrical engineering degree is simply going to have different financial consequences than sending them off to school to get a psychology degree. Some engineers may not pan out, but most will do very, very well compared to the average income, and most psychology majors will not. It's just the data. And that's not to say that there isn't intrinsic value in studying psychology or studying history or studying comparative literature or lots of other topics. It's just we shouldn't fool people into thinking it doesn't really matter what you major in or even what institution you attend. If you go to college, on average, you will boost your income by 40% or whatever the number is. And that's not accurate. That's what we might call the fallacy of the average. Just because something is true on average doesn't mean it's going to be true for you.
What help me with – I've got a – pretend I've got a son or a daughter who's getting ready to go to college.
Yeah.
And so the advice, look, if you're doing this for money, be careful. Not everybody who gets a college degree makes more income than somebody who went to the community college and has a specific trade basis. Is that – Do you get into that kind of counseling? Is that what
yes,
I have to do?
Yes, that's one kind of advice you might give somebody. But also, DG, it's just a question. It's not even a question of you might not make as money as somebody else who learned auto mechanics and all ended up owning a business. That's true. But this is even more specific to the individual person you're talking to, that you personally, given your abilities and skills, you may do very well financially if you go off to university and major in a higher than average paying profession or something like that. But you have certain skills. The college will upgrade a little bit. But some of the reason you would get into college is because you study a lot, you work hard, you more or less meet deadlines, you have some basic intellectual capacity. And so you personally can't assume that the reason you might 10 years from now be making $80,000 is because you went to college. You might have been making $80,000 anyway because you have the bundle of skills that would let you do that. So yes, the advice here is go in eyes wide open. If you, particularly a family that first-time college goer, family that is not affluent, be very thoughtful about what degree you choose. There are certain degrees that have higher financial payoffs than others. It is not, however, to say everyone should do STEM. That is, I would never argue that. I didn't. And I think that that's preposterous. Obviously, everybody can't be an engineer. And furthermore, as I was saying earlier, I know you know people and I know people who have majored in very demanding STEM fields or law or something like that and have gone off and done very well financially, but they're unfulfilled. And they might be a very, very well-paid investment counselor, but they would be happier as a high school history teacher. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, our purpose is for people to be happy, in my view. It's not simply to maximize, you know, GDP the way we measure it. So I would tell people who, as I thought about when I went off to college, I thought about going into the performing arts. Going into the performing arts can be very rewarding. It will very rarely be lucrative, but it will be very rewarding for lots of people. And you don't necessarily have to go to college to do it. That's going to add you additional costs. It's going to take you out of the full-time workforce for 4, 5, 6 years. You're going to pay all these bills. And the difference between what you would make with that college degree and what you did is not very big. And so think about something else. That's advice to the person who's interested in that field. And then I think the conclusion for everybody else is we need to lean into the alternatives that provide people training that they need. It could be community colleges. It could be other kinds of institutions that give people the training they need to pursue certain kinds of professions, avocations that they enjoy but are not very lucrative. And we're not going to make them lucrative. We can't pass a law that makes the average actor make anywhere close to the national average for an adult. That's just not going to happen. We're not going to do that for technical theater. I teach dance on the side, DG. And so I certainly don't do it to earn significant income, but I would always be able to – I would always love to be able to teach dancing. I teach tweens and teens tap dancing. If you're going to go into the tap – into the dance business, as many of my friends did, you probably don't need a college education. What you need is a low-cost operation. You need to really think about who your audience is. You need to be really good at dancing and teaching. And alternatively, you might figure out a way to get a credential to be a teacher.
Well, John, let me interrupt you because you don't think there is a value you may not be able to quantify it for the dancer to say you're like, get your dancing, do your dancing, but you're going to be in the arts community. You're going to enjoy it more. You're going to get a better personal satisfaction if you understand the whole arts scheme. Mm-hmm. And you're more likely to get that. You could do it by individual study and all of that, but you're more likely to get it in a collegiate atmosphere where there are other people. And you're going to get to know people who will enrich your life. So I'm just making the argument that a dancer can look at college and say, this is really a negative return on investment, but it's going to make me a better dancer and a better person if I have the university type experience.
That's a reasonable position. I think it might be true for many people. If your financial wherewithal is such you're not particularly worried about the financial payoff of college, by all means do it. But I will have to tell you, I know a number of people who go into this field and they don't have a lot of money and they're never going to have a lot of money and their families don't have a lot of money. And the value that you just described of going off to college is not zero to them, but it may not be worth all that money. Because after all, this is where one of the places I wanted to go here. I believe very much, and I said in the column, I believe very much in education as having intrinsic value. I literally mean that people. I wish more people enjoyed sitting in under a willow tree talking about Plato's dialogues. I do, okay? But we couldn't possibly have a huge higher education sector spending what it does, costing what it does, consuming the resources that it does, employing all the people, in order to satisfy the number of people who genuinely want to do that.
Well,
that would be a much smaller sector. It would be the kind of higher education sector we used to have, which was for elites. It was very small until the 1950s, really. College was for a very small percentage of people who were elites, and they were going to become professionals or leaders or ministers or something like that. And some of what they did was profession-related, and a lot of it was just kind of intrinsic value of higher learning. And I think that everybody has the potential, and I would want everybody to have the desire to pursue intrinsic, you know, knowledge for its own sake. But I don't think college is the most cost-effective way to do that. There are lots of other ways we could do that now with modern technology, and people do it all the time. And I think that we should encourage people to study music and to read about Shakespeare and so forth. And I don't think that sending them off to a college for that purpose alone is probably a good use of resources. And they don't, because they wouldn't pay for it if they had to.
I'm visiting with John Hood, and we're talking about the cost of college and whether or not people who pay that high cost of college and university have a chance to get their money back, or maybe more than their money back, or maybe have a deficit. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is John Hood. We're discussing college educations and their and its cost of a college and university education. And our basic consideration is whether what is the return on investment if you pay $200,000 to go to fine college? Will the skills and attitudes and habits that you learn in that university experience pay off for you more than it would if you had just gone straight into your occupation? Well, John, how are we going to use this information? How do you suggest that we use it? And what difference will it make if everybody pays attention to and to the return on investment argument and makes their decisions based on that?
Well, I have a perfect record of predicting the future, DJ. Not that I want anybody to check. I don't want them to go back and see what I said about the 2016 election or any other of the predictions that may not have been entirely accurate. So in this case, again, I'll say we could speculate or we could just observe what people are already doing. So I was just describing the information that is now available. But people had kind of a fairly accurate guess about this even a decade or two ago. So if you simply look at the degree programs enrollment, not just in North Carolina but around the country, and you look at what fields are growing rapidly and what fields are shrinking, people are already acting on this information. So your nursing programs, your engineering programs, generally speaking, most of the STEM programs, economics, business, a number of these fields are growing rapidly in terms of enrollment.
All of these I still call it computer-related education.
My younger son is getting his degree in computer science. So those are rapidly growing fields in terms of enrollment. History is shrinking. Literature is shrinking. English is shrinking. What we might call area and specified studies. Studies of particular regions, African-American studies. These are stagnant or declining. It's not because people don't care about literature or area studies or psychology or something. It's because they know that, and certainly their parents looking over their shoulder know, yeah, but you can't get a good job with this degree. And of course, that's a bit overstated. You can get a good job with almost any degree, but on average, you know, for the average person, you're just going to maximize your income by going into one of these other fields. So lots of students are already acting on this. I think that will continue. I think that universities have to adjust. It's very painful. You probably know, and I certainly know, people who are very upset that their departments are shrinking, that when that senior professor retires, they will not be replaced, that a department that used to have a number of tenured professors will probably only have two, and the rest of the courses will be taught by adjuncts. So this is already happening, and people can be upset about it or not. I understand why they're upset about it. But my view is, since it's already happening, it is likely to continue to happen as people think more about the cost and return on investment for higher education, then I think that there are a couple of policy things we can do at least. One of them genuinely is don't just worry about the payoff. Worry about the cost. We get to figure out, and I think Mitch Daniels at Purdue University is an example, and there are some other leaders around the country. We really have to genuinely reduce the cost of delivering education, not just changing who pays the cost, but genuinely making it less expensive to deliver the service.
Almost a whole other topic, and maybe even more important than the topic that we're talking about.
Well, it's related, though, because if you can reduce the 4 or 5 year cost, and there's a lot of ways to do that. You could do it through sort of economizing on what people get for the program. You could do it in terms of remote versus in person. You could do it in terms of an adjunct versus a full time. You can also do it, though, in terms of how long does it take. Probably one of the smartest things to do would be to figure out ways to get people done faster, to get students faster through the process, certainly to avoid the fifth and sixth year, and arguably to get that get it down to 3 years. That sounds ridiculous, except there are lots of countries in the world where that's how you do undergraduate education. It takes 3 years. So the cost side is essential. If you can reduce the cost in a variety of ways, from remote learning to reducing non-faculty personnel costs to reducing facility costs to reducing textbook costs, there's all sorts of things on the cost side. And DG, if you can pull the cost down, lots more majors become financially a plus side, right? So that's one solution is to reduce
Well,
cost.
Let me interrupt you. And I apologize for doing that because if we simply look at the reducing the cost of higher education and eliminating some of these things, it's really hard to quantify. But you and I both know that part of the value of the university experience is the collegiality of the you learn from your fellow students, you learn from growing up in a time of sort of the kind of supervision that you get from and support that you get from a university experience. It is costly. That experience, and you could argue that, gosh, I could sit you down at home and put you in front of a computer and I can deliver the lectures that you get from even better prepared lecturers than you're going to get in person. And that by eliminating that experience, you do eliminate the cost, but you also reduce the value, I think, of the end product of people who have gotten the benefit of a collegial experience. I don't know how you quantify that, but I argue that it is valuable.
There's sort of like all kinds of services. There's sort of premium versions of the service, and there's kind of regular versions, and there's pared down versions. And I guess my argument is I don't want to remove the possibility of people getting premium level higher education. I teach at Duke, and lots of students there would have no interest in the cost being reduced. They can afford it, and they like the premium experience they get, and that's fine with me. But my view is we need to have a gradient of options available that includes lower cost options for people who they don't have the time or the money to have that collegial experience you're talking about, but they genuinely want to get a degree, and maybe not just at a STEM field. They want to get a degree in political science or get a degree in psychology or something like that. And the alternative is not to get a really, really expensive premium version of it because it's not really in the cards for them. It doesn't make financial sense to them. So the better option is to give them an alternative that is less expensive that still has some value to it. So that's what I think about the cost side. But I also think we genuinely have to consider the possibility that a lot of the non-pecuniary benefits of higher education that you're talking about, which are very real, cannot productively be delivered to anything like most Americans. It's right now, you know, the college going rate has kind of not grown a whole lot lately, but it's in that sort of, I'm going to get these numbers wrong, but it's in the 20s, it's in the 20 percentiles that ultimately get a bachelor's degree. And I don't think you get that to 45 or 50%. I think that would be impossible. I think it would be exorbitantly expensive versus whatever benefits we could guess. I don't think that's going to happen. But I would like more than a quarter of Americans to have some education, some real and rigorous and fascinating educational experiences after high school. I'm just convinced we're going to have to do that through, you know, teaching company lecture series and discussion groups and lecture brilliantly led, low cost, almost volunteer kinds of community groups and activities. We just need to be thinking much more broadly about how to expose as many people as possible to the life of the mind, which I think is great, without thinking that means sending everybody off to some college. I don't think that's a realistic scenario.
Let's talk some more about those options. We need to take a break. And those of you who joined us late, I'm visiting with John Hood in the context of a provocative newspaper column that he wrote recently about what the return on investment in terms of do you get your money back if you go to college or university. John Hood and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with John Hood. He and I are talking about the cost of college education and whether or not people who pay a pretty high tuition in America these days, whether or not there's any hope that they will get a positive return on their investment. John, you learned a lot of other things as you wrestled with this question. What's the most important thing?
We tend to think about services like higher education as additive. The more you get it, the more value you get out of it, which is, of course, kind of hard to quibble with. But there's big stages. To go off to college and spend a year and a half and then not finish your degree, you will learn some things. You will have some positive experiences. It doesn't have, like, if you went 2 years out of a four-year degree, you don't get half of the benefit of getting the bachelor's degree. If you don't end up with that credential that signifies that you finished that program, then you don't get even worth close to half of the value than if you finished the program. So that's one of the reasons why I've come around – this was years ago, but I came around to the idea that we really need to encourage what we might call a marginal student who could succeed at a four-year school, but is not – their scores are sort of good enough to get in but not spectacular. Community college for 2 years, closer to home, less likely to sort of fall off the deep end when they go get away from home, as some kids do. And also, if you did the two-year degree and got your associate's or got some other degree, but because we have the articulation agreement and lots of other good arrangements, there's some new ones that are coming on board just now, which I think are fantastic. The Wake Tech, for example, the biggest community college in the state, has some new partnerships with East Carolina and NC State that have to do with engineering programs. So you get 2 years, and you actually get something that signifies what you've already gotten. Two-year degree doesn't have to be just an associate's in arts and sciences. It could be a two-year degree in computer tech or industrial engineering or something like that. Now, that you now have an opportunity to go then seamlessly to university and finish your undergraduate degree. But let's say you don't. You know, that's about as much school, it turns out, that you wanted to take. Now you've got something that is marketable, not I went to NC State for half the time and I didn't finish, please hire me, is a different pitch than I went to Wake Tech and I have this fantastic certification. And you know, because you've already hired six people from this program, how good it is. That's a better pitch economically. Doesn't mean that you'll have the same experience at on the campus of NC State as you would on the campus of Wake Tech. So my point is simply we need to have lots of options. They need to be rationally talking to each other. So years ago when you would go off to community college and do a year or two, but then you tried to transfer into UNC Greensboro and your credits didn't transfer, that was very frustrating. It was a waste of everybody's money and time. We've more or less solved a lot of those problems with the articulation agreements and changing the way community colleges do their credit hours. And so I'm optimistic about this. I just think people need to be realistic that we're not talking about sending – the goal of our legislature, our university leaders, our community college leaders, our business leaders should not be to maximize the number of people who go off to get a four-year
Let me now you're getting into a place where we can have a satisfying difference of opinion. My feeling is that advanced education, college, community college, more education for its population is really, in almost every case, but certainly on the average, is good for the community. The better educated our community is, and that better educated, or more education, both technical and otherwise, our community is better off. And you look around, I mean, I look at Singapore, for instance, where, and compare it with Malaysia. And Singapore, they takes the attitude, we want our people to get as much education as they will take, really, and almost force feed it on them. Other countries kind of are lazy about it and don't appreciate that difference. I'd like for our country to be one that says, we want our population to be better educated. One more thing about this, that all of us who have that view go back to the post-World War II experience when we had the GI Bill and all the veterans coming back and getting the benefit of higher education that we never would have gotten, that the community, that the country benefited from that. I don't hear any of that in your thinking about the return on investment.
Well, most veterans coming back from World War II did not go off to college and get degrees. I mean, it certainly, in the GI Bill and similar programs, certainly significantly increased the number of Americans who went off to college. And I'm not against having subsidies to encourage people to go off to college. But we didn't think that most veterans would go to college. They did not. The college going rate was never that high.
A lot more than before.
It had previously been it's very important for people to own this, that genuinely until the period you're talking about, higher education was not a mass experience. The University of North Carolina was not, in its purpose was not to engage a large number of people. It was an elite institution that trained a very small number of people. That's too elite. That's too elite for me. Okay. It needs to be much broader than that. However, to say it shouldn't be an elite institution, in my view, is not to say on the other end, everybody should do it, or almost everybody should do it. There's a sweet spot in the middle. And I usually am in the middle, DG. You know, I'm a moderate on so many things. We had too few opportunities for people with great ability and great promise and great ability to serve others to go to college before the mid-20th century. It's much more difficult to say today that there are large numbers of people who are likely to succeed at UNC Chapel Hill or UNC Charlotte who cannot get there. That's a much harder – so what we're actually talking about are students who are sort of on the bubble. We could get them into a school. They might not graduate, and the graduation rates for some of our institutions in the public system and in some of our private schools, some of them have improved recently, though I'm not entirely sure that was good. Yeah. It could be that there's some great inflation going on, but it's still pretty low. Some of these schools, it's still depressingly low. And we got to think about that. You don't want to bait and switch people either. You know, everybody knows you got to go to college, we say. We say that over and over again. Kids sort of quasi-motivated but feels compelled to do it. She goes off to school. She takes 2 years' worth of programming. She did some well on some courses, not so well on others. She dropped out. She spent a lot of time and money. We have spent a lot of money helping her do that. And that may not have been good advice for her. And I think it's irresponsible to tell everyone you're going to succeed in a university environment. Many will not, at least if you want the university environment to be truly rigorous. And it's okay. There are many other ways that people can enrich their lives. And people did this. Think about that period after World War II where many, but not most, veterans went off to school, mostly men. Well, the women who didn't have college degrees, like, you know, my relatives, that doesn't mean that they were uneducated. It doesn't mean they didn't have intellectual experiences. They did all sorts of other things. They had book clubs. They read books.
I'm having to interrupt you just to give you an alert that we got to pay a minute more. And is there a point that we haven't gotten to that you'd like to make in conclusion?
It's simply that people need to be making informed choices. We need to be giving people an array of options. We shouldn't tell them that one option is sort of inherently good or inherently bad, because there are lots of different pathways for people, not just to gain financial success or accomplish their financial goals, but to have a fulfilled and productive life. University education is one of those. It is a valuable thing. I believe in it. I teach at a university. I'm all for it. But for lots of people, that's not the right answer. And we need to make sure we're not giving them any false information, any kinds of pressure to do something that is not really something they want to do or is in their interest.
That's John it. Hood, thanks. Thanks for sharing, first of all, your great column about the cost of higher education and the return on investment, and then for discussing with us today.
Thank you.
John Hood has been my guest. I want to thank him, and I want to thank all of you for listening. This is D.G. Martin who's talking, and I'll be back here before.